We've never had any system that could benefit you, but that also benefits everybody else. Usually it's taking away from. And it's like, wow, I could just buy Bitcoin and hold it. And now, because of that scarcity, I've just, you know, the people in Zimbabwe or Argentina or Lebanon, or whatever, the value of theirs has just incrementally gone up by the percentage of the network that I own. The biggest problem with real estate is that it's not set it and forget it. It's really a second job. Do you really want to be a landlord? Do you want to deal with the toilets, with the trash, with the tenants? Or do you really just want the money that that gives you? Owning homes is really just rent rebranded, where you're paying your money to the government. You're paying it to the bank, because why am I paying property taxes on something that I own? As we educate people on what Bitcoin is and how Bitcoin can do what real estate does, but in a superior fashion, you know, why take the risk?
If you enjoy this podcast and you want to learn more about Bitcoin, then make sure to subscribe to our free newsletter. Every Friday, we send out insights into macro, Bitcoin on-chain, and Bitcoin mining. Join over 100,000 existing subscribers by clicking the link in the description or going to newsletter.blockwareintelligence.com.
This video is sponsored by Stampseed. You plan on holding your Bitcoin for decades, so you need to make sure that your seed phrase is documented in something that can last just as long. Stampseed's signature titanium plates and stamping kits do just that. If you simply write your Bitcoin seed phrase down on a piece of paper, it's vulnerable to fire, water, and all sorts of erosion that can happen over time. Make sure you keep it secure for years to come. Head to stampseed.com and use the code BLOCKWARE15 for 15% off the entire website.
You wouldn't walk down the street with a giant sign that has your home address on it. So why would you do the same on the internet? You need to use a VPN. Orca VPN is a service that encrypts your internet connection and hides your IP address, ensuring your online activities are private and secure. Orca VPN works on all different devices: Windows, Mac, iOS, Android, and Linux. Head to orcavpn.co and use the code BLOCKWARE, and you can access Orca VPN for just $1.99 a month. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can ensure that all your internet activity is private and secure. Again, that's orcavpn.co, orcavpn.co.
Welcome back to the BLOCKWARE podcast. This week I have on Terrence Michael at Proof of Money. Terrence, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Mitchell, or Mitch.
Yeah, either one's fine. So we met in LA at the Pacific Bitcoin Conference, and we were able to chat a little bit there, but I'm excited to really dive deep. And I know your background is in Hollywood and real estate, according to your Twitter profile. So can you dive into, you know, who are you for the audience that may not be familiar?
Yeah, so those two buckets are sort of like the main fiat areas where I was, you know, pre-programmed and preconditioned, you know, raised, educated to sort of monetize my skills and to sort of optimize everything that I could. Like, my proof of work, you know, before Bitcoin came along, was in story and in sort of leveraging property as we knew it. So whether it was real estate or whether it was movies, it's like, you know, Bitcoin does this reverse engineering thing on our brains, right? As we know, where it helps us look at everything that we've been doing. And it's like, oh, you were doing that because of something that was broken. You were doing that because you had to do that. And even though I wouldn't change, you know, all of the experiences that I have, and I still love and I'm still very passionate about Hollywood and real estate, you don't have to take the chances and you don't have to, your incentives change, which is the thing that Bitcoin shows you. So for me, like, the quick 411 is that I went into Hollywood, I went into movies. It was a lot of raising money. It's very competitive, which is great. It actually leans into proof of work, Hollywood does. But the problem is, a lot of the proof of work, meaning what you do to raise money, to get story, to hire crews and to market and to hopefully make some money on your product, it gets sort of distorted when a proof of stake system comes in, right? Someone can come into Hollywood who hasn't either worked their way up, hasn't done the work, doesn't understand how to tell a good story or how to make a good movie, but because they have tax incentives, because they're part of a corporate structure, because they're from another country, they'll come in with a pile of money, make a bunch of crappy movies, but they've taken away the landscape and the distribution system from you. It's like only so many movies could be distributed. There's only so many pipelines. Mm-hmm. And really there's like, you know, four or five companies that control all of Hollywood. That's it. And it's the same seven stories over and over that we tell. And if you have, so the, I'm sorry, Mitchell, I'm jumping all over the place just because my brain is jumping in forward into Bitcoin.
Yeah, I know you're asking. Let it all out.
Okay, I know you're asking about my past. So the seven stories that we continue to tell over and over again, it's more just about, it's about the execution of the hero's journey. That's really all it is. Every movie that you've ever seen, if you didn't like the movie, if you didn't enjoy it, if you didn't tell your friends, it's because the struggle wasn't there, the ordeal, the trials and the tribulations. Like, you know, you need that obstacle. You need that ordeal. You need to find your mentor and you need to sort of cross the threshold and transform. And I don't mean to sound too woo-woo, but it's a lot like Bitcoin, right? Like we come for the number go up technology. We find altcoins, we go into DeFi and CeFi and scams and leverage. And we learn the hard way by sort of, you know, going through this valley of death, so to speak. And movies, every movie sort of needs that for the journey to be fulfilling. For the movie to be fulfilling, the transformation, there had to have been a struggle. You know, it's very rare. Like, I don't know about you, but I know very few people. I could probably count on one hand that just came into Bitcoin, fully understood and studied Bitcoin and bought Bitcoin, and that was it. They just sat on their hands. Like, amazing if you can do that. And by the way, if I did that, I would have way, way, way less Bitcoin. It's like going through that journey that you learn how important it is because you see what it can do by what the other, how the other things have distorted your preferences, how they've distorted your choices. So in Hollywood, that happens all the time. You can have all this proof of work. You know, the average film takes 7 years to make. Like any film that you like, and if you read about it and you see the writers and how many places they had to pitch it and the book they had to adapt and how many other studios turned it down, like it's a long struggle, even if you're the 0.1% of all those screenplays that gets made. And that's literally the odds, 0.1% of all these screenplays finally make it there. So with proof of stake, what happens is a lot of these, you know, rich trust fund people or people from other countries will come into Hollywood and they'll just sort of obliterate and devalue and essentially debase what we're doing in trying to make our own movies that we've struggled for and, you know, just to cobble the money together and get out there. 20 movies in, as I started to make it in Hollywood, I started to see how a lot of my friends were having trouble with mortgages and real estate. And you would think, you know, people in Hollywood, they make such good money and that's where they naturally want to do. They want to buy their own house and then eventually they want to have income properties and they want Airbnb businesses and they want to be landlords, or so they say. And Hollywood's kind of like, we're kind of like gypsies. It's kind of like a circus. It's a very much a blue collar town. It's the, banks don't want to lend to people in Hollywood. They hate people in Hollywood because you don't know how well your movie or TV show is going to do. You don't know when you're going to get your next check. There's a lot of people that are unemployed all the time. And as you may have heard in the mainstream media recently, we've had these strikes that have been lasting for months. You know, for everyone from the writers to the actors, and now to some of the other unions. And so a lot of people are out of work. So I started a mortgage company, which is what started my real estate journey, where I started to help all my friends and help a lot of people in Hollywood get mortgages. And when I saw how real estate started to get financed, I started buying my own stuff, started flipping my own stuff, started buying, selling, and then I had an Airbnb business and I was doing active investments where I owned the property and fixed it up, or I was doing passive ones where I'm part of like a syndicate or something like that. And the syndicates became very popular because they're a little bit more hands-off. But you know, it's only in hindsight that I realized through all of that, we were just printing money. That's all we're doing because, as you know, the fiat system is completely credit-based. And so, you know, I lived through the 2008 financial crisis. And so when I look back and I think about how, you know, what influenced Satoshi to release the white paper and to start Bitcoin, it's like, I get it now. Like, I was on the privileged side because I was in time where I got to take advantage of all this money printing. I had all of the easy credit, and I could, and I had a company that made the easy credit. Like, I had a money printer for my friends in a sense, because they wanted cheap homes. Great. Here's 2% and 3% mortgages, you know, some of them putting down 3% to 5%, you know. It's kind of crazy when I look back in hindsight. Now, obviously, a lot of people have to take personal responsibility and they've got to be accountable for their actions and their choices and the debt they take on. But, you know, if you are an accredited investor or you can afford to get into real estate, you know, when you're trying to hurdle inflation, it's like, I was always taught, most people were taught that that's the best play out there. Like, what else are you going to do, right? Like, our piggy banks are broken and you're not going to have your money just sit in a savings account. So beyond buying like a small little modest house for yourself, suddenly you're like, oh, well, maybe I should buy another. Maybe I should buy a third or a fourth.
Yeah.
And that's where I went, and I just kind of went crazy, you know, and it's like 20 properties in, I was like, I thought I was a genius. I wrote a whole book about it, about all kinds of real estate strategies. And I mean, I'm still proud of those. I mean, those still work within an inflationary currency system. But now that you see that there's a better monetary system, you just don't need to do that. So aside from all the rambling, so that's
ridiculous. Was that a tough amount of switch to?
What's that?
Yeah, that was great, Terrence. There's a lot we can unpack there. From when you, because you wrote a whole book about real estate, obviously you're super into that. Was it hard to really digest Bitcoin and realize, you know, all this success you've had in real estate was just pretty much off the back of fiat money? Was that a humbling experience when you realized that?
Absolutely. And partly it's because, you know, we grow up with this like activity bias, right? It like this busyness. We think we need to be doing something. Like, if we're not effectuating something ourselves, we can't just make money. You can't just sit by and have money. And so real estate is just so obvious and tangible. And I could work with my hands and I could put up a wall and I could paint. And, you know, it sounded like proof of work, which on one hand, it really is. Like, if you really can work on real estate and add value where you're increasing the utility value, you're adding a room, you're adding a story, I think that's fantastic. But yes, once I was learning about Bitcoin, that look, I don't need to distort the value of a utility for someone that really needs one just because my piggy bank is broken. So now I'm going to monetize this utility asset and increase the prices so they can't afford a home, but it works for me because, you know, the price of all of this real estate is just going up like crazy. But I never in a million years thought it would be that was happening. Not because of me, but it was happening because there's just more dollars in the system, right? Like, the value of that house didn't go up. Mm-hmm. The value of the dollar went down. So it's requiring more of those same, you know, political units to acquire the same real estate. So that is a very humbling experience in many respects to realize that, you know, because this is what I tell my friends, like just the other day, like every day through my mortgage company, people are calling me because they're trying to get loans to either have more income properties, more passive income, or, you know, to start an Airbnb business. They all want to do something. And I always ask them this question, which is the first orange peeling part for a lot of real estate people. It's one, it's like, do you really want to own that place over in Nashville or in Austin or wherever? Or do you just like the flex? Do you want to go to a party and say, oh yeah, I've got a place in Austin, I've got a place in Nashville? And if they're really honest, if they're being, you know, genuine, a lot of times they like the flex. Two, do you really want to be a landlord? Do you want to deal with the toilets, with the trash, with the tenants? Or do you really just want the money that gives you? You know, and when you think about it, it's like, well, who really wants to be a landlord? Even some of the biggest landlords out there, do you really, really want to do that? Or do you want the money that it gives you? So It's all we've known, right? And what do we have, like $900 trillion in our system? And there's what, 325, 350 trillion in real estate? And a lot of that's just in passive real estate. That's not in just single homes. So it's like, imagine as people can shift out of that, can concentrate on their first job, not have a second job of learning how to be a broker or a handyman or a carpenter or a real estate agent, you know, or a property expert, and put that into something that's pure and egalitarian and basically gives you peace, because it can grow your wealth in a way that wealth was meant to grow from scarcity and from holding. So,
yeah. I mean, that's really well said. And I think to just sort of clarify for the audience, because that was really so well said, but we may be jumping like five levels ahead of where
I jumped all over the place. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So like Bitcoin, because, you know, real estate has these two conflicting things driving up the price, which you mentioned. You have the utility value. People want to live in this house because they want to raise their family there. They need a roof over their head. And then you have the monetary value, which is the dollar sucks. Investors, which is just everyday people, people need somewhere to store their wealth. So they're bidding up the price of real estate because it is somewhat limited in supply and there's always going to be demand for it. That's but Bitcoin's right. better at that property because it's actually truly scarce. You don't have to be a landlord. You don't have to take out the trash and manage tenants. You don't have property taxes. You don't have maintenance. You don't have all of that. For all those reasons, Bitcoin is a superior store value because of its properties and the fact that it's liquid, right? If you're trying to sell a house, you need to hire a real estate agent. There's a 3% commission fee. It's going to take months or depending on the time of the market. It's just uncertainty there. It's not divisible, right? Which creates this barrier to entry. Like poor people can't really buy real estate. They can't save their wealth that way. The more money you have, the more credit worthy you are. You can buy more real estate, but anybody can buy any amount of Bitcoin. So it's just such an interesting juxtaposition there of, you know, why Bitcoin is so much better at being a store of value than real estate. Do you think this sort of like demonetization, right, where capital goes into Bitcoin when it otherwise would have went into real estate, do you think that's a real possible scenario? And if so, how long do you think that transition will take?
I think it's starting to take place already right now because, one, with interest rates higher, people don't like the cost of that debt. And so they're looking for other places. As well as we educate people on what Bitcoin is and how Bitcoin can do what real estate does, but in a superior fashion, you know, why take the risk? And as you just pointed out, that is the biggest problem with real estate is that it's not set it and forget it. It's really a second job. And, you know, like the government can, you know, so like I once lived at a place that was, you know, right by LAX, right by the beach, but right by LAX. And if I looked across the street, there were no houses there. There one point was, but the airport kept expanding. I was literally on the 0 yard line with my little house, like looking at land owned by the airport. At any time, and I looked into this because I got concerned, if the airport expands again, they would just take my house and they're not necessarily going to give me market value. And this is something that I essentially owned, right? But it's like, we know that owning homes is really just rent rebranded where you're paying your money to the government, you're paying it to the bank, because why am I paying property taxes on something that I own? I get it. If I'm selling, you want the capital gains tax, which I look as a penalty for having left fiat and put it into something else and coming back. So it's like, here's a capital gains tax. But like with Bitcoin, and you look at it as pristine collateral where it's like, well, I never need to sell Bitcoin. You know, the wealthy, even the wealthy that own real estate and continue to acquire more real estate, they never really sell it. They use it as collateral. But it's not pristine collateral, right? Because it deteriorates, because it needs maintenance, because it's not liquid. You can't move it, you know, as the environment changes. And you can't change the utility. If you own a set of storage units, they're always going to be storage units. If you own a high rise, I mean, look what's happening to the to commercial real estate in the office market right now. Like it's completely collapsing right now. They're just sitting empty. I just read recently in San Francisco and in Chicago, they're being sold for like 10% of what they were purchased, these big, huge office buildings. So if you love real estate, if you love working on things and flipping and you can add utility, you know, I think it's great. I still love real estate. But for people that really just want to save their excess contribution to society because they've been that effective, they've been that productive, and they've given more value than they've taken, and they want to carry that forward in time, real estate really isn't the best. That's the big idea, that it's like that if you have to earn in this melting currency, if you have to, you know, treat it as a hot potato. You have to get it out of that and into money as quickly as possible. And it's kind of why I named my book Proof of Money. My thesis is that we've never had money. We've had surrogates, we've had attempts, we've had substitutes. What could we find on the ground or in the ocean or on a mountain? What could we dig up? But now, for the first time ever, we have perfect, because we've engineered it, because now that we're in the digital age, we can make it for what it's supposed to be. So real estate became big before we could make money. We didn't have perfect money. So when you don't have perfect money, and this could be semantics, I separate money and currency, but when you don't have perfect money, this airtight adiabatic system, you need a currency that is moving as quickly as possible. But just like you said, if you can't get at the top of that currency, like real estate, then you're stuck down here as a wage earner. And so the cost of everything, your education and your fuel and your food, everything is just going up. And I'm not telling you anything you don't know, Mitchell, but that was sort of the big idea for me with the transition from real estate into Bitcoin. And mostly for people who don't really want to fix up houses, who aren't, you know, contractors. And if you can do that, I get that. There's a thing for that. And I produced those shows, you know, on HGTV. Like I get it. And there's a part of me that loves it. And because I love design and I love improving things, but I can do that. I have the skills for that. Most people don't. And so if you're hiring out for all of that stuff, you're just eating into the whole reason you had real estate in the first place.
Yeah, that was well said. It feels like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're still selling mortgages. So everything you're saying, it feels like it's going against your incentives, right? You would not be incentivized to tell people buy Bitcoin instead of real estate. So how do you sort of wrestle with that?
Well, it's funny you say that, because I am, and I'm very aware of that. You know, nowadays I completely flat out tell people don't do this. Don't go into that. Don't buy that. You know, here's why. Like, you can do what you want, but here's why it's easier. And, you know, I give them a copy of my book. I send them to podcasts. I use that as an opportunity to orange pill them, because once they start asking the questions, then it's fine. I mean, look, here's the reality for that. Like, the mortgages are like one of, I don't know, I probably had like 10 side hustles, you know, before I found Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And you know, now I have a lot few, but it's just one side hustle that started out as a benefit to just friends and family. And then it benefited me with my own real estate, and then it grew into a business, but I could care less. And I mean, that could go away tomorrow. That's the thing. It's not something that I'm passionate about. I just have the hack to rewrite the narrative for people in Hollywood that the banks don't understand. Bank of America, Chase, Wells Fargo, they don't know how a director in Hollywood makes money. They don't get it, or a cameraman. They don't get it. So I change that for them, because I'm just the broker, and I go and get the loan for them at the bank and I bring it to them. So, interesting. So someone that really wants that, needs that, I like that I can help them, but it's more that. Yeah. I'm not pushing it. I have zero ads. I've never done a mortgage ad in my life. I'm never out there, hey, come to me. Nope. You got to find me. That's it. You find me.
Interesting. I like that. So I want to rewind to something you touched on at the very beginning, which is the idea of the hero's journey, which as I understand it, someone who loosely paid attention in English class growing up, it's like, You have to go through a struggle, and then on the other side of that, you're a stronger, more well-rounded individual. Do you think because I don't know what your thoughts are on the idea of the fourth turning, you know, hard times make strong men, make easy times make weak men. If we're in that phase of a lot of weak men, would you agree that the hero's journey has sort of been absent from society within the last 80 or so years?
Yes, exactly. So like, right. So there's one huge overall hero's journey, right? Then there's our lives, which are a hero's journey. And then everything that we're pursuing, we have the hero's journey in, you know, Bitcoin, hero's journey in a relationship with diet, with health, with exercise, right? We all have these little and big ones. So what you're talking about is like on the global, global grand, right? 8 billion people, what's happening? Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe so, because I believe, you know, with the wars and especially with COVID, I think a lot of people's eyes have been opened to what's really going on. And we see how programmed we've been, how conditioned we've been, how much we've been lied to. You know, like when we're born, you know, it's like we reach out to our parents and, you know, we trust our parents and it's like, whatever they say, that's it. And we grow up that way. It's like, oh, you go to school, your professors, your icons, everyone you look up to. So whatever they say is golden, right? Like that's the law. Like, well, if they say so, I trust them. And now for the first time, and I think especially because of what happened during COVID, people are learning to challenge trust. So we are at that point, I think, in the hero's journey where people are like, oh, wait a minute, maybe I'm listening to the wrong person or following the wrong person. I need to do some of my own studying, some of my own research, some of my own learning, and look throughout history and figure out what's really happening and find what's better for me, which is why I like Bitcoin, because Bitcoin leans into and aligns with that heuristic of self-sovereignty, of doing your own research, of learning, and doing it in a fair way. Like, we've never had an asset or a money or a protocol, or we've never had any system that could benefit you but that also benefits everybody else. Usually it's taking away from. And it's like, wow, mm-hmm. I could just buy Bitcoin and hold it. And now, because of that scarcity, I've just, you know, the people in Zimbabwe or Argentina or Lebanon or whatever, the value of theirs has just incrementally gone up by the percentage of the network that I own. So yeah, we are on our hero's journey in that, and we're now realizing that.
Yeah, Bitcoin's so fascinating the way it gets all incentives to work towards its success. It's incredible. I've never seen anything like it. One of the institutions that has lied to people a lot and is part of that distrust is Hollywood. Do you have any insights there and any, you know, things you've seen throughout your career that could speak to that?
Yeah, that's a loaded question. I'm trying to think of a simple answer. I was just talking to Daniel Prince about this. It's like, you know, Hollywood is a very much a cancel culture. They've always been. And not always on the right side. In hindsight, they often realize what their mistakes are. But, you know, like there was a time not long ago in Hollywood where like the actors or whoever couldn't come out as gay and they got canceled. Their TV shows got canceled. They no longer got hired. Well, you probably laugh at that now because like they promote that. It's almost reverse discrimination now with that. And the same thing happened with women. The same thing happened with black people. The same, like they go through these cycles and then suddenly it's like, we just need black movies. Or now we just need movies with women. We're going to take Ocean's 11 and Ghostbusters and all these classics. And now let's do the version with, you know, just women. So Hollywood, it's not that they have, I'll tell you exactly what it is technically. So they send out these mandates. I get these mandates in my email all the time. And, you know, Universal, Warner Brothers, whoever, they'll say, this is what we need. So they're telling producers like me to come pitch them, find these scripts, these books, develop them, bring them to us, you know, we'll finance it. And you know, they'll say, hey, we want things that, you know, promote wellness or that talk about the climate or make corporations out to be bad people. Or like during the whole Ukraine war, it's like Russians suddenly are ending up being the bad guys in all these spy thrillers and all these movies where, you know, a while back that was a no-no. It's like, no, we're not going to make fun of Russians. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you want to make your movie and if it's incidental, you suddenly are just changing it. Okay, that bad guy's a Russian guy. But all of that starts to leak, you know, through the mainstream media and like the viewers who maybe are unaware, it's starting to feed their heads of these things like, oh, well, you know, I need to be open to gender neutrality, or I need to be open to the fact that, yeah, these things are dangerous for the climate. You know, we should have electric cars, you know. So here's the struggle. If you want to make your movie, you kind of have to make it fit because that's what they're looking for. They call them mandates. That's what they're looking for at the time. Yeah. And it shifts all the time. And if not, you're completely independent and you're on your own and you're risking your money. You're risking your investors' money. You're going to go to the film festival, sell it, do everything you can, and you hope you make your money. But that's the struggle. And every now and then, one of those breaks out and it changes the narrative. And that's the tough part.
Wow.
But that's also why I've been on the independent side the whole time. Like I never started out making big studio movies. I've been making independent movies that I sell to the studios because I don't want to sit in that. I don't want to sit in the same narrative as they do.
Yeah. Well, that really blows my mind. Like I understood some of that ahead of time, but the fact that they're actually sending out emails, like we want this narrative pushed through Hollywood, work on scripts that fit that. And that just perverts all the incentives.
It'll blow your mind.
If you want to get the funding and you want to be a successful movie director, if that's been your ambition your whole life, like now you have to conform to this narrative, to their patterns. It's interesting. How do you think about, you know, you said you were an independent film producer. We've seen sort of the rise of alternative media. You've got like a company like the Daily Wire now basically launched their own version of Netflix, which, you know, hopefully they don't swing to the other side of the spectrum, right? And be like cancellation from the right.
Right.
But is that something, do you expect to see more of and sort of like Hollywood almost become decentralized over time?
That's what I would love. I think that would be great, you know, to let the people decide. You know, if you look at, for instance, like faith-based movies, which most people, you know, that's its own genre and most people don't know about them. But guess what? They come out, they have a huge impact, and they're one of the most profitable type of movies you could make. They're hugely popular. And so it's like, well, so where are all those people going to see the movies? Like, why aren't we making more of those? And, you know, eventually Hollywood is just a bunch of shareholders for a big corporation and they just want to make money. That's it. So if there's a way that we as producers can say, look, this is really what we want to make. This is really what the people want. You know, we don't need to fall in line with you, Hollywood. We're just going to do it. And if we can connect a way for those to be profitable, Hollywood will come around. They always come around. It's just they're on this cycle and they're not always on where they should be. And they get, I mean, you already know this, but you know, they chase whatever's successful, like that's it. And you don't make much more, you know? And it's like right now, guess what's super successful? Small horror movies, you know, Saw, you know, Insidious, all that. Like that's why you're just seeing tons of those. They can be made super inexpensively. They're fun. The teenagers love them. And I get that. But me personally, I'm not nuts about, you know, I don't need to see another movie like that right now. But as a producer, if I want to get that financed, that's what I concentrate on. And if I want to make my investors money, that's what I concentrate on. I look like a hero. I've done a great job as a producer. If I want to take a chance and grab some book or, you know, write the mystery of Satoshi and his whole life, like, you know, I would love to do that. But, you know, I'm taking a risk. Do people care? Do people want to see a movie about Satoshi?
Right.
You and I want to, but do other people care?
I would watch that in a heartbeat. It reminds me of what Saif Adin talked about in the Bitcoin Standard, which is how fine art was better on a gold standard. And as we shifted to fiat, you get like modern art and it's just like watered down nothingness. Would you say the same thing accurately said about movies? Because to be honest, all the classics, quote unquote, are like 70s and 80s.
That's right. No, you hit the nail on the head. That was a perfect analogy. And that's the problem, right? Fiat distorts incentives. It distorts human action. It distorts everything. And that's the problem. So when the studios are putting up north of 100 million, right? Maybe you're putting up 40 million to make the movie, 60 to 70 million just to market it. What are you going to do? Are you going to put out Trolls 4, the cartoon, you know, for kids? Or are you going to take a chance on some cool, you know, period piece about Alan Turing or, you know, how the internet was created or, you know, whatever. And unfortunately, the numbers show that, you know, a lot of America is stupid. A lot of people want just mindless, numb entertainment, things that are too enlightening or too engaging. If they have to think too much, and unfortunately, that's what movies are, right? They're burned out. They've worked all day. They've worked hard, and they just want something to not have to think. Now, that's not everybody, of course. We know that, but Hollywood thinks that's everybody. And so if you don't make that, you're not going to get it funded. And so now you're out trying to – I mean, because that's what I've had to do with all my movies, Mitchell. It's like I'd spend years, and it's like I have to go raise $3 to $5 million. Most all my movies were the $3 to $5 million range. One was 18, and a couple were probably sub a million. But that was my jam. And it's like you're pounding the pavement. And then it's like as a producer, as a business owner, you know, you have a duty to these investors. You know that money represents their hard work. And because Bitcoin wasn't around, they're just trying to hurdle inflation themselves. You know, they're not making the movie. They're not hanging out with the actors or whatever. So I fall into that same fiat game. I have no choice because it's like, okay, great. You gave me your hard-earned money. I want to return that to you and then some.
Right.
You know, and that's why Saifedean, I'm sure, was talking about it with real estate because it's so true. And, you know, and all the real estate deals too, and you want to flip it and you want to make it fast and you want to get it out the door. And so people are slapping together stuff really fast. I mean, look at the drywall behind you, right? Like that was part of the fiat system post-World War II. Yeah. How do we get a bunch of houses up really fast? I have it too. And drywall's great. It works fast. But like those post-World War II houses, that's why they were so cheap and square and like we've lost all that cool European detail and everything where people spent centuries building, right?
Yeah, it's a shame. Thankfully, where I live down in the South, we still have some of that like really old 1800s type of architecture. But you know,
I love that.
these cookie cutter type places just keep on popping up. We can we could sort of shift here, and I want to talk about something that you brought to mind. And since you brought this up on Spaces and then I tweeted out, I've seen it really start to circulate is this idea of the spot ETF and unit bias. So can you dive into that and, you know, just how big, how big are the implications here as far as unit bias in Bitcoin and this ETF?
I think they're pretty big, you know, because, you know, psychologically we have this bias to complete something whole, to complete one. You know, you give a slice of pizza, your unit bias says, I'm going to finish that slice. So like people that are trying to lose weight, they start cutting smaller slices because it's like, oh, I need to finish a whole slice. People come into Bitcoin. I just talked to someone yesterday about this. They're like, oh, I really want to get into Bitcoin, but you know, wow, $37,000 for a Bitcoin. And you know, that's when, you know, us Bitcoiners know, it's like, well, no, that is the market price of one Bitcoin, but that really is representing 100 billion Satoshis. And so, you know, sometimes I tell people, it's like, what if there were $1 million bill and that was your money? You know, can you work all day and get $1 million bill? Or, you know, do you want to pay for your food with $1 million bill? Well, no, you can take just a fraction of that. So we know that. But right now, the way Bitcoin is purchased on exchanges and then hopefully taken into self-custody, but it's priced in Bitcoin and not priced in Satoshis. So everyone thinks, you know, their unit bias says I need to have a whole one. But yes, we know we can buy $100 worth, $50, $2 worth. The ETFs that are coming very, very soon and potentially 10 to 12 of them will, I think, remove that unit bias because they will probably all be priced in their own shares of how much Bitcoin they themselves have or however they decide to price it. So they might say, hey, you can buy a Bitcoin share for $50, $25, $18. And yeah, with the same sort of incentives that brought people into crypto because, oh my God, look at Dogecoin. It's only 2 cents. Wow, I can have a bunch of them. I think they'll say, oh, shares of Bitcoin are $50. Great, let me buy 10 of them. So 500 of them. And our unit bias will say, I have 10. That feels like something versus saying, I have 0.00001 of a Bitcoin. So I think that on top of the ETFs just helping people find Bitcoin in the first place, even though not in the most perfect and with the best utility, they at least will get their feet wet. The unit bias, I think, is also something that, as you tweeted, Mitchell, is I don't know that that's priced in, so to speak.
Yeah, I agree. And you've also mentioned this unit bias game theory, right? Because if there's 12 ETFs, there's sort of a race to the bottom. Like, oh yeah, our ETF is only $3. So buy this one and buy the BlackRock one instead of the Fidelity one or vice versa. So such an interesting dynamic. I'm excited to see how it plays out.
Yeah. And speaking of that competition, you're right. Yeah. Oh, this ETF, it's $10 for the Bitcoin here. It's $3. Well, wow, I should buy it over there, right? We know it's the same. However much Bitcoin you have is how much Bitcoin you have. But think about this. If there's like 10 to 12 ETFs all coming, and I think they might be approved all at the same point. I don't know what you're thinking, but wouldn't there be competition in other areas? Like one, wouldn't they start to compete as far as proof of reserves? Will one of these ETFs or more suddenly say, here's on chain, here's our address, you can see the actual Bitcoin, right? So you're not just holding paper Bitcoin, you actually have it. Two, which one might start to have redemptions or actually take it even further? Which one will let you hold one of your own keys to the Bitcoin? I mean, like that would be just game changing. And on one hand, maybe it's not even an ETF. I don't know enough about them that that's even possible. But you know, my understanding is that they have to be one-to-one, that they're going to be regulated, that they have to be transparent, that people are going to be. But I think the wording of them is they're technically allowed to rehypothecate them. That's the part that could be concerning. I could be wrong. I read somewhere that they have the ability to do that.
Well, they definitely would have the ability. I guess the legality would be the question, but here's my thing on that is,
Oh, right.
We've seen how this plays out when you try to rehypothecate Bitcoin. FTX was founded in 2019. They lasted 3 years doing paper rehypothecation of Bitcoin. It just does not work fundamentally. Gold, they got away with it for decades on end because it's analog, it's physical. You're not going to get everyone to go ask for their gold back all at once. But with Bitcoin, that could very easily happen. You get one tweet rumor or one, you know, fake coin telegraph leak that such and such ETF doesn't have the Bitcoin they say. Everyone rushed to withdraw at once. And that's the end of it, right? It can end like that. So FTX went down overnight, basically. So I think even if one of them foolishly tried to rehypothecate Bitcoin, I don't think that paper Bitcoins could sustain for very long.
Agree. And I think that's, I'm sensing that that's potentially one, why they would want to approve of all of these at once, right? Because that would mitigate the risk. And two, it would incentivize them to, I mean, like if I'm Kathy Wood and I'm running her ARK Invest Bitcoin ETF, and I want people to come to mine versus like a well-known name, like a Fidelity or a BlackRock, what can I do to get them there? Like, oh, you know, here's an address. Here's a key. By the way, we will never rehypothecate, like, or whatever. You know, like, there's got to be a way that we can audit that. I mean, this is what's great about pure Bitcoin, right? It gets rid of all these problems. But at least for people taking that first step into ETFs, the pensioners, the boomers, and, you know, all the institutional money, they don't know. I mean, you know, my whole life I've owned stocks and mutual funds and stuff in, you know, just passive because that's what, you know, I'm told to have some bonds, have some stocks, all this stuff. But I don't know where they are. I don't know who has them. I don't know what they're doing with that. I'm sure they're even rehypothecating that. But because it's just a number on a ledger, I've never lost it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a security, right? It's not, isn't that really all ETFs are doing? They're securitizing a commodity.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, like I can't hold the barrel of oil, so I'll trade it.
Yeah,
in paper.
It's interesting. Let's go down this rabbit hole then. Of you're right, that ETF does not give you the full utility of Bitcoin. You're not actually holding the commodity; you're holding a securitized version. Part of why the ETF I think makes sense at this moment in time is because more sophisticated custodial solutions that are also user friendly have not been built out yet. You and I know it's easy to keep track of 12 words, but that's something a boomer is not necessarily going to be comfortable with.
Right.
Part of what's fixing that is collaborative custody. And you have now partnered with the Bitcoin Advisor, if I understand correctly. So can you speak a little bit? And, you know, we had Peter Dunworth on about a couple of weeks ago. So we've sort of gone down this rabbit hole, but I want to hear it from your perspective. What exactly is collaborative custody? Why does this make sense as the best way to hold your Bitcoin?
So I think it makes sense for a couple of reasons, but for one, so dovetailing from the ETFs, if a lot of the people that are coming into ETFs are boomers, institutions, passive pensions, you know, registered investment advisors, you know, universities, family offices, big money, they don't really have time like we do to go through and read a bunch of books and learn the technicals of Bitcoin and understand self-custody. As easy as you and I think it is, I mean, you give me 5 minutes, I'll whip up a hardware, blah, 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 it's done. But what they have is they have the money. So they are in a system where they trust institutions. Now, they're learning from everything they've read, like you just talked about with FTX and everything, to not trust any one institution. So with collaborative custody, the idea is that rather than one key, you have a quorum of keys. So let's say you have three keys for a wallet and you, Mitchell, might want to hang on to two of those. And, you know, you can keep one at your place. You throw one at your dad's house in another continent or whatever, or another state, and your two keys will sign the transaction. So you know this, just like having a checking account and, hey, there's three guys, they want to start a business, but any two of those guys need to sign to transact the money. The collaborative custody takes it a step further where it says, Mitchell, you may not be great or comfortable holding your two keys, and you may be concerned that giving one to your dad or your aunt or your girlfriend or whatever, that could be compromising. Like someone could bust into your dad's house and be like, hey, here's a key. Where's your son live? You know, and then so collaborative custody would say, well, Mitchell, why don't you, let's back it off and have you just now hold one of these three keys, and let's have two separate institutions each hold a key that don't talk to each other, aren't part of the same company, and potentially even on different continents as they are in my case with the Bitcoin Advisor. Now, it's still your keys. You still are needed to sign any transaction. Only you can log on to one institution over on the left and sign and send your Bitcoin, or to the institution over on the right. Those two never, ever need to talk to each other. And in fact, they legally can't and won't unless something happens to you. And these two institutions, the one on the left and the right, are holding your trust or your deed or your will or something that says, hey, everybody, prove that I'm dead, and because I've named you in my trust or my will, now these two can sign together to get that money to the people that you want to get it to. And you can even take that a step further. This isn't for me, but this is definitely for a lot of people, going back to the ETF people and to institutions, where those three keys, you don't even hold one of them. Now, I know that sounds completely incongruent with everything you and I know, and believe me, it is incongruent with me, but some of these people, like Jesse Myers, his company OnRamp, they do this. The three keys are just three different institutions.
Interesting.
And so, yeah. And so it's like, well, wow, what if I had all my money and I could have Vanguard and I could have Fidelity and I could have Morgan Stanley? It's like, okay, as long as they're not going to collude and I have proof of that and it's on chain and I can see the addresses and there's quarterly, sign-ons and everything. Okay, I get that because like some people never ever want to hold a key. That's the issue. Now, I at least want to hold one, and in many cases want to hold two, or in many cases want to hold all of them. But if you're good about thinking about every scenario, where do the keys go? Separately, where do the words go if I lose those keys and need to recreate them? You know, and where, and what happens if someone finds one and then this and another? So it's a lot to think about. I mean, I'm constantly thinking about my own system. I'm constantly upgrading my own system. But now that I'm at the Bitcoin Advisor, I'm really happy that, you know, I have these two separate institutions for some of my money that I can count on should something happen to me. Like for some money, if something happens to me, there's a treasure map for my family. I hope you guys can read the clues and I hope you guys can find everything you need to. And I have a dead man switch, which you and I talked about on a Spaces once, that will get the right information to them should I pass. But for other money, it's just show my proof of death and these institutions have it. So I think like the ETFs,
I was going to say that this is it right here. This solves every single problem that I can feasibly think of when it comes to Bitcoin custody, because you above all else, you have the option to be completely sovereign, hold all the keys yourself, trust no one, rely on no one. Step down, you can give one key to someone else, provide safety and backup in case you lose one key. You still have the key that you have, and then they have the key. And then it solves this major problem, which is inheritance. If you just have one single SIG, you don't tell anyone where it's at, and you croak, your family has no way to get that unless they just dig through every hole in your yard and go through all your stuff, and maybe they'll find it, but maybe you hid it somewhere else, right? So
that's right.
You can have this death certificate, right? They have to verifiably prove, you know, you have to see my dead body before you'll sign a transaction, basically. And it's so fascinating. And then what I really like about how y'all are set up at the BTC Advisor is y'all are literally all on different continents. Y'all have someone on every continent except Antarctica. So you can take that geographic distribution of keys like to the extreme.
Yeah, and I think just like our, you know, own hero's journey through Bitcoin and going through crypto and CeFi scams and all of that, I think we all sort of go through that, even the hardcore Bitcoiners with our own setups. Like we all started off with one hardware wallet and we thought that was fine, you know, and then suddenly it was like, and I was good with that. And then suddenly it was like, add a passphrase. It's like, oh, wait, what's that? Oh, wow, you can go, you add it. It's basically a 25th word instead of 24. And then it was like, oh, now you can go multi-sig. Okay, great. Then you're doing multi-sig. But then it's like, now you can collaborate with the multi-sig. And, you know, we take it one step further at the Bitcoin Advisor, and soon this is going to be everywhere, where we do time locking. And, you know, it's like, what if you lose two of the three keys and you're stuck with one key? That doesn't work because you have to have two or three keys. Well, what if you wrote in the code, what if you rewrote a program that said, well, in 10 years, just one of those keys work. It's like, what? So I didn't really lose it all. I just can't touch it for a while. And in some cases, that's actually a good thing.
Yeah.
Or you want to pass it on to someone and not until they forceful hodling. Exactly. So I think that's another just genius way. And as well as like giving it to your kids. Like I want to give this money to my kids, but well, I don't want you to have it when you're 7 years old. If I prematurely die, you know, I won't want you to wait till a certain age when you can appreciate it and understand what this amount of money will mean.
Yeah.
I don't personally know how the time locking, you know, the smart contract works, but Peter and Andy and those guys who run the advisor, they know all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. They've come on it and explained it actually on this show as well. I'll make sure to link that in the description. About Bitcoin. It's programmatic money, and it doesn't get talked about and appreciated enough that you can code different behavior mechanisms into your custody solutions. People, when they think about, you know, Bitcoin as a digital money, they often think about, you know, soft forks, hard forks, how can we optimize the chain, do all this, whatever. But what's fascinating to me is this idea of time locking. This Bitcoin cannot be sent until certain block height, or, you know, this key works after a certain amount of blocks. It's so, so fascinating. And we can't even fathom. There's so many things that we can't think about now that will be discovered 10, 20, 30 years from now, different ways to program this to just be better money, because it's already perfect money, but it could be even more perfect. Theoretically, there's just concepts we haven't even thought of yet.
Yeah, like when you think about the Fourier cycles that we go through, the bulls and the bears in Bitcoin, if you really are doing what you're saying you're doing, and if you really are saying, okay, I'm getting into Bitcoin, realizing that I have to sit on my hands and endure the bear, you almost could time lock yourself for the bear and just say, you know what, I'm just going to time lock it so I don't even have to think about it. Just get rid of the noise.
Yeah, that's one way to do it for sure. Terrence, I really appreciate you coming on. This has been a good conversation. And the way I like to always wrap it up is by asking the guests, what does Bitcoin mean to you?
To me, it means peace of mind that my hard work won't go wasted into the future.
Yeah, I definitely concur with that. And Bitcoin, because of that concept, it's made me actually work harder, knowing that it's not going to be for nothing, right? I'm going to be able to see the fruits of my labor in the future. So that was really well said. Where can the audience find you, and where do you want to send them to see what you're doing?
They can just connect with me or find me on Twitter X, or just Twitter or just X, at Proof of Money. That's where I am. That's where we all are.
Yeah, that's a fact. I met someone recently who's into Bitcoin, but they weren't on Twitter, and that blew my mind. I'm like, what? No way. It's like, yeah, I've heard about Bitcoin Twitter, but I am just not on there. I was like, dude, you got to get on. It's great. And Terrence, you do host one of the best spaces with West Coast Bitcoin Bulls. So everybody, it's Wednesday at 2 p.m. Pacific. You guys gotta come through. It's a good time.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and Mitch is there most of the time. So yeah, you guys should come listen to him. He's got great takes.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Make sure to like and subscribe. We'll see you next week.